So we have on the West Coast earthquakes, on the East Coast tropical cyclones, and in the center we have going up and down to Canada, we have severe convective storm. We have straight line winds more in the north. So everybody gets their fair share.
Good morning, good evening. Matthew Grant here. And outside the comfort of our podcast studio, we are back in conference and event season now in London and in New York. And it's been great to meet so many more of you face to face. So if you're out and about and you do come across myself or any of the Instate team, do please come and say hello. We'd love to see the faces behind the listeners. We might even get a chance to get you on stage or even on the podcast. Well, we're going back into my previous career today, and I'm talking to Dag Lohman and Brandon Katz from CatRisk about their catastrophe models for flood, tornado, hail, and more. Now, CatRisk has been quietly but rather successfully growing over the last 10 years, and it recently took in significant investment from TA Associates. Look, we're getting a bit technical in some places, but hang in there, because I usually check back with Dag and Brandon to make sure at least I'm understanding what they're saying, and so hopefully you can too. And yes, we're going to come back and explain those acronyms too. Well, finally, if you're in the US or you're traveling to New York, we are running our next event out there, back with Google on the 4th of June, and we'd love to see you. Information on the website, www.instec.co, about that, everything else we're doing in London, and of course, we'd love to also talk to you about membership too, if you're intrigued about that. Right, let's get on with the show. Dag, Brandon, great to see you. Another of my former colleagues, we'll be talking about that as we go, and another great company that's been set up to solve a problem. I think, Dag, you saw yourself in the past, talking a bit more about that in a minute. You're both in the US. Dag, are you over in the West Coast just now?
That's right. I'm in our Berkeley office. We have four small offices all around the country and in Germany. So I'm in Berkeley, California. Brent is in Austin, Texas.
So let's kick off with a bit of an introduction, and then we're going to find out what you're up to. So CatRisk, you're a catastrophe modeling company. You're providing global inland flood, storm surge, and windstorm loss assessments, and you've got some of the largest insurers, reinsurers, and brokers in the world as your clients. And if I talk to you, I shouldn't say surprised how many more you've got, but I think for a company that's still relatively new, really impressive number of organizations are working with you. I founded back in 2012, and you recently... You brought in TA Associates as a strategic investor. Dag, you're one of the co-founders. Brandon, you're EVP and head of strategy. And as I mentioned, we all worked together before you founded CatRisk. Dag, anything critical I've missed on there before we go on?
No, that's a good summary. We bootstrapped ourselves as well in the beginning. So there was no outside funding. And then last year, we took a big investment from TA Associates to grow the company even faster.
Bootstrapping a business when you're building models is quite a challenge, just given traditionally some of the compute power and access to data and paying people that could probably have gone to other places must have been quite a driver to get clients early on when you first started in 2012.
Yeah, it took us a while. It took us about 2 years to get the first clients, 3.5 years to become profitable so that Brandon could come on board.
Well, nothing quite like spending your own money to focus your mind on where you spend that money. So yeah, congratulations on those early bootstrap days, and also great to see TA coming in. As you think about the problems that your clients are coming to you to solve, both reinsurers and some insurers, how would you sort of characterize that in simple terms?
We saw in 2012 an opportunity to enter the flood market. We knew that products that were in the market didn't answer our clients' questions. What are the correlated risks from tropical cyclone, inland flood, and storm surge? Then what are the correlated risks around the globe? Is there clustering of events due to climate? And so that made us start the company with a premise that we need to build global correlations first, and then build local, regional, continental risk models. And then the other one was really the correlation between models. So wind, storm surge, inland flood. Another aspect was technology. Building with a fresh start, fresh new ideas of how things could be done, I think that gave us an opportunity from the start to build on upcoming technology, on, in our case, modeling on graphics cards. Overall, seeing the opportunity in the marketplace for these type of products I described earlier.
being a company of scientists and people that are interested in always learning new things and being curious, one of our defining features was our openness to collaborate with our clients and wanting to make sure that everything that we did was entirely transparent. For us, it's always been really important that we're as transparent with our clients as possible so that anything that we're doing, they can question us. And if they have better information, they can modify their own models and basically own their risk from their perspective. So that's been a very important part of our ethos, is to always make sure that we're as transparent and open as possible with our clients, because we're always going to be curious. We're scientists. So if somebody knows better than us, then they can tell us. And we can always have those open conversations with our clients.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really smart thing to do, I think, Brandon, because a lot of your users, or most of your users, are going to be quite sophisticated. They know it's not going to be a single absolute answer. There's uncertainty in the data. You've got to make decisions about how you bring that data together and create probabilities. And certainly my experience has been the more transparent the way people are and how they build models, then it is more the user can take their own view of the risk. So yeah, I can see why that makes absolute sense. And then Dag, just in there, you mentioned about using graphics cards. So you're kind of foreshadowing what we've seen with NVIDIA with the use of, you know, what they started off creating graphics cards and chips for gaming, the sort of first really way of creating a powerful chipset to be able to do the analysis. Now, of course, generative AI. But the timing was very good for you, wasn't it? Because that was basically about the time that you could start getting cheaper cloud compute and more powerful analytics more cheaply than it would have been even a few years earlier.
That's entirely true. So graphics cards, the coding for graphics cards, in our case, NVIDIA, like most other ones in those days, started in earnest around 2009, 2010. So it was already in the marketplace. The development toolkits were in the marketplace. But then in 2012, 2013, the US Department of Energy built a supercomputer with NVIDIA graphics cards that, and we applied for compute time on that computer, and we got an award that allowed us to really leverage 10,000s of graphics cards at the same time and run our simulations on GPUs and be done with them much, much faster. So the first 2 years were really work of getting our own infrastructure up, making sure we can operate the supercomputer and work on this hybrid architecture, which is still the main architecture today. So if you want to run on supercomputers today, you have to be able to code on a GPU, CPU, accelerator card enabled machine.
And you also just mentioned correlations in there. It's essentially if you have a flood event in the US that could be connected to a cyclone happening somewhere else in the world. Could you just talk a little bit more about that from a modeling point of view? You require the computing power to do that, but what else were you doing at the time to be able to connect those different types of perils together?
The way we split our thinking up is, on the one hand, there's climate change that goes forward over the time span of decades, where we go into new weather regimes, new extremes, almost new weather paradigms potentially. But then there's this intermediate scale, that climate variability scale. So will we have a warm summer, a cold winter, a wet winter? And what are the signals that determine that globally? And the signals that determine that globally largely come from sea surface temperature. Sea surface is about 2/3 of the globe. And patterns, and people know the name of these patterns. The most important one is the ENSO pattern, which is the warm equatorial Pacific, or the water temperature in the Pacific and the anomaly of that. So when ENSO is happening, like we have right now a negative ENSO, a La Nina, probably this summer, then a couple of things are happening around the globe. You will have more droughts in Australia. We have more floods in the US. When ENSO is positive, less tropical cyclone making landfall in the US. But as is like this year, when you have a negative ENSO signal, so you have a colder equatorial Pacific, then suddenly you don't have as much shear and more hurricanes might actually make landfall in the United States. And that's part of the reason why we have these elevated hurricane predictions right now. Our solution for climate variability was to model global sea surface temperature first, 40,000 years of that with all the anomalies, and then build all the models around the globe. So our Australia flood models, our global wind models, our European inland flood model, our US models, Canada models, to merging climate science a bit more with catastrophe modeling science.
And there's a lot of discussion going around about the use of traditional catastrophe models given changes in the climate, but it's an important distinction in terms of the climate variability sort of year on year, which is arguably is or is not connected to a broader long-term climate change. But what you're talking about here is really more about that variation year on year, isn't it?
Also working on climate, we look forward in five-year chunks, so 2025, 2030, 2035, 2040, and then in 10-year chunks forward. So we do climate change, which is a slow varying variable. And on top of that, we get the climate fluctuations with climate variability in the teleconnections. And then on even shorter time scales, we do CAT response. So what's happening in the next 10 days? But underlying all of that is a catastrophe modeling catalog of 50,000 years that we condition to reflect nature as well as possible.
Can you talk about the use cases for your clients?
Yeah, for modeling in general, the high-resolution models, say flood as an example. So in the United States, we're modeling at 10 meter by 10 meter resolution, so 30 feet by 30 feet, which is on the scale of a single home or maybe a part of a single home. So that's become a really important piece of business for us. We have a lot of clients that are using our models for point-of-sale underwriting. So they've been using that for 5, 6, 7, 8 years now. Some of our longer-term clients, that's a fairly mature product. And that's really evolved over time with clients now moving into the admitted market. So a lot of these location-level loss analytics have been getting approved by various insurance commissioners. So we've done a lot of work with them, a lot of education, a lot of opportunities. I've had a few meetings now working with the NAIC, so the North American Insurance Commissioners, educating them on how these models work. Because traditionally, a lot of these rating plans that would get admitted are more typically for these models like earthquake, and wind are much, much higher resolution, right? So they're thinking about, let's do rating plans on the postcode level. Let's do rating plans on other larger aggregation levels. And having to do a lot of education to make people understand that now we need to move to a grid-based, a high-resolution grid-based resolution. That's all powered by the fact that we had to use the Titan supercomputer, which, of course, at the time, I think Dag mentioned was the largest supercomputer in the world, to be able to create these really, really high-resolution models. And it really matters. Typically, the streets flood first. So if you're, let's say that you're geocoding a house and you want to make sure you have an address, you want to know what the latitude longitude of that house is. When I first started into CAT modeling, a lot of these geocodings were done at the street level. And if you model floods at the street level, you actually flood a lot more frequently and you can increase your average annual loss and your pure premium by a fairly large percentages, getting into the hundreds of percentages, right? And that's because the streets flood first. And so now some of these companies with geocoding are making sure that we're geocoding to the actual rooftop of a building, which can really give you a better sense of the risk. And these things, all these components are incredibly important for a high-resolution hazard such as flood to be able to do these premium underwriting analytics at the location level. All that has to do with the education and the insurance commissioners. They're not used to seeing these high-resolution models. And that's really the way that the industry, I think, is going.
Brandon, because before we get on to SEO, I want to come back, Brandon, to that point you made there about rating in the admitted market, because some people understand this, but not everybody. In the US, the rates have to be filed, and you talk about the admitted carriers, those are the large insurance organizations as opposed to the business that comes out of the US. There is quite a lot of pressure from consumers around the rates that insurers are charging, and it's quite a sensitive topic around this. So it's worth me commenting that the ability for you to get approval for rates being filed is quite a milestone to achieve for a company, because there's a lot of rigor that goes into this. And particularly, as you mentioned, the earthquake and windstorm, they've been doing this for a while, but flood is relatively new because it's only starting to move into the retail market. So that does, to me, feel like quite a major milestone.
One of our data partners that's utilizing our model, the Appleseed project, which has basically gotten our product admitted now, I believe, in between 40 and 50 states now. That's basically a separate product, but then we have our individual clients that have been going through and getting admitted in most all states now. There's been a lot of education. Again, each time we submit to one of these insurance commissioners, we get emails, we get questions. We have to share some additional data so they get comfortable around grid-based rating curves, but it is fairly well accepted in the United States at this point.
So another aspect, and you mentioned that, Matthew, is our location-level results are exactly the portfolio results. You just add up locations and you get the portfolio result. That also hasn't been the case for many of the other CAT models have been used in the past. So if you underwrite a location, you can just add that. It's entirely risk additive to our overall portfolio solution. I think that's also a big part of our success, that people see that there's a mathematical framework with coherent risk measures in place.
I want to just to go on severe convective storm. We're hearing a lot about hail, tornado in the US. That's another area for you, isn't it? Is there specific examples you can give there of people you're working with, or what are you doing in that space?
Severe convective storms models largely suffered from a mix of technology problem and methodology problem, I would say. The first one is, can you resolve tornadoes or not? Tornadoes have to be resolved at the scale of, let's say, 100 meters, maybe 50 meters, somewhere in there, where you can actually model individual tornadoes. And then can you have a platform that can model enough of these tornadoes to give you still results within a reasonable amount of time? And so we spent a lot of work ourselves on making sure that losses are converged, tornadoes are resolved, tornadoes, straight down wind and hail are connected with each other, and also at the same time connected to the teleconnections that were mentioned earlier.
And Dag, when you talk about tornado resolving, just to make sure I understand that, that is essentially you're creating a representation at a sufficiently granular level of the potential tornadoes so that when you run the model, you're getting a representative sample set of tornadoes. Would that be a fair way of characterizing what you just said?
That's right. So tornado has two features. One, they're very frequent in the United States. And second, they're very small. And so being hit by an individual tornado in a model is very unlikely. In many grid cells, that doesn't happen before, let's say, 20, 30, 50,000 year return period. In more than the United States, almost it is that case. And so you need to model many, many years in a peril that has very small footprints and where it's really down to luck. But you have many of them. So that creates computational problems that we think can now be solved for the first time with the tornado resolving model that goes down to the spatial scales that tornado are happening and still models the right frequency, the right severity at the right locations in our catastrophe model.
Just working that backwards. So are you saying because you get some cells that have got like one in 50,000 chance of being hit, that would mean, I guess it varies by area. Well, of course it does. But in some cases, you've got like a one in 50,000 chance of your property being hit by a tornado.
That's right. Even exactly. And so then you don't have losses that are converged. You need to come up with smart sampling methodologies for tornadoes themselves. In some other grids or some other areas, it is not one in 50,000, but it's still on the order of one in 500, one in 1,000 in areas where you have frequent tornadoes. And so you still need to model a lot of tornadoes to have a converged EP curve. And you need to have a modeling platform that's fast enough to go through your whole catalog of tornadoes and compute losses that are then also correlated with straight line winds and with hail events. So it's essentially a mix of highest frequency peril with the smallest footprints in a climate modulated environment that also has three correlated perils with each other and can execute with a runtime that our clients still find acceptable.
So the three correlated perils are straight line wind, hail, and tornadoes.
Yes, that's entirely correct. And we're connected then also to our hurricane models to some extent from a climatological point of view. But yes, that's entirely correct.
And I mean, just again, back on the social impact. So what you're saying there, some cells, therefore some properties have got a likelihood of one in 100 being hit by a tornado. It's kind of interesting if you're living in that area, you know, for people's perception of risk. It's just kind of intriguing. You'd live somewhere. I guess you didn't have much choice. It's like living in San Francisco, like living in California, Dag. You've got a 1 in 100 probability of your property being destroyed by a tornado, but people still choose to live or have to live there.
Earthquake in my case. Yeah. Yeah. So we have that dipole almost, right? So we have on the West Coast earthquakes, on the East Coast, tropical cyclones. And in the center, we have going up and down to Canada, we have severe convective storm. We have straight line winds more in the north. So everybody gets their fair share. Everybody gets inland flooding, though. That's the one piece. Also, from an average annual loss perspective, where it's not necessarily dominating the other ones, especially not in the P curve, but it's more frequent and we have more events per year than, let's say, with hurricanes, for example.
I'm glad to say with earthquakes, because it probably will happen now. But I mean, I was around back in the 90s when Northridge and Leonard Prater happened, and we tend to forget earthquakes happen in the US, but of course that's the big threat. But I was wondering where would it be, just on your point about you get all these perils, where would be your recommendation for the safest place to live in the US then, where you're kind of minimizing all of those perils?
I would go with the top of a mountain in the Rockies. Very top of the mountain in the Rockies, because no one's...
Yeah.
You have winter storm then, but...
you get freeze.
Yeah.
Montana, maybe. Wyoming, right up there.
And then, of course, you're talking about sort of validation for what you've done. You've worked with some catastrophe bonds for FEMA. Might be useful talking about those, because there's also pretty rigorous assessment that goes into models that are used for those.
That's right. So we've essentially different solutions, right? So underwriting, portfolio management, and risk transfer. Underwriting would be our location-level API or location-level data that people can use. Portfolio is almost the same as risk transfer. So that is our platform SpatialCat, which is our portfolio solution where we then compute sometimes cat bonds, sometimes parametric, sometimes indemnity-based. So we were, since 2018, the calculation agent for the National Flood Insurance Program from FEMA in the United States that transferred a total of, I think, more than $2.5 billion of flood risk from the National Flood Insurance Program into capital markets. So we have, our solution covers underwriting, portfolio management, and risk transfer. In our case, we were the calculation agent for the FEMA National Flood Insurance Program, the catastrophe bonds, FloodSmart Re, that transferred over the last 7 years more than $2.5 billion of flood risk from the NFIP into capital markets. So we did those calculations. We also, the backbone for some parametric insurance solutions. But overall, our platform, SpatialCat, is our portfolio platform that can run in underwriting mode. So it can run very quickly a single location in the seconds time scale or a small portfolio, and then can run large portfolios up to tens of millions of locations, either within minutes or hours at the longest on a decent sized computer.
And then just some other examples that you're working on. So you've done some work in the UK looking at the climate reporting for the FCA. Brandon, can you talk a little bit more about what you've been doing there?
Yeah, some of the climate analysis that Dag mentioned earlier, being able to model future scenarios before RCP scenarios, now with the latest IPCC climate report, SSP scenarios coming up, is that we've been the primary folks that our clients have been using within the UK to be able to do those TCFD reports. And where I think that gets interesting, say, in the United States, is that the SEC has been proposing similar legislation within the United States. And in fact, just 2 weeks ago, I believe, on the Thursday 2 weeks ago, they started trying to initiate some of those policies in the United States. They put some things forward, and they've already gotten some legal pushback. So that's on hold, although it's expected to move forward. And I think where that gets interesting is a lot of times with these climate things, what happens in the UK eventually trickles down to the United States. So a lot of this required mandatory climate reporting that if you have a significant book of structural buildings and these kind of things within your portfolio of business, you have to be able to say, hey, this is the risk to these locations in the future. And so I think a lot of that is really interesting from the SEC side, because yes, we're talking about insurance. We're talking about people that are really interested in climate change. And I think actually insurance has been, from the financial industry, one of the forerunners of the people that are actually looking at climate change, because they see it in their books. They're already starting to see some things changing. Where that also gets interesting is beginning to look into adjacent markets like the mortgage industry and these other people that have significant books of business that involve structural policies. And so the climate change reporting in the United States, as it comes online in the next handful of years from the SEC, will mimic what's going on with the TCFD and hopefully expand the uses of catastrophe models into other adjacent fields like the mortgage industry. Because one of the things I always like to think about, who cares about climate change structural risk? Well, mortgages are oftentimes 30 years, and 30 years is roughly the time scale in which we think climate change becomes more and more and more significant. So kind of jumping around a little bit there. But I think from the climate reporting standpoint, we've been doing it from the beginning since the TCFD was organized and put forth in the United Kingdom. And we're continuing to make sure that every model that we have, where there is defensible science, that we're making sure we're using the latest accepted science to be able to model those possible future events.
Well, a lot of acronyms in there, Brandon. I'm going to get some of them. You might have to help me with a couple of others. So we had TCFD, which in the UK is Europe Task Force for Climate Related Financial Disclosures. It's a pretty big requirement now. As you said, it's kind of starting to move over into the US. You mentioned RCP, which is a representative concentration pathways for looking at different climate scenarios. And then you've got the Securities and Exchange Commission, and that's where they're starting to look at how companies are reporting on their individual buildings' Is that right?
That's correct. And they're basically putting forth similar policies to the TCFD. They're also working with the insurance commissioners, the NAIC, to be able to figure out how these policies should look. And if you look at them, they're not all that dissimilar to what's going on in the UK.
Great. NAIC, National Association of Insurance Commissioners.
That's the one.
I've got my acronyms. Yeah. Right. So a lot going on. It's just a reminder that insurance touches so many other areas as well. And we're going to start seeing more and more moving into the more traditional financial markets from reporting. Can we talk a little bit about how the models being used? So you've got an insurer modeler using these in a day-to-day job. What does it look like for them when they're sitting at their desk and they've got a screen in front of them?
So we have our primaries and our brokers and our reinsurers. And I would say from the primary perspective, a lot of that has to do with the underwriting side and looking at portfolio roll-up. So of course, the whole pipeline starts with a client putting in a latitude and longitude or an address into a location and getting in a premium, and you've bound a single policy. Then the next step in the process is you get all those policies and bring them into a single account or a large portfolio. And then the day-to-day is them using our spatial cap product or probabilistic models to figure out what is their loss for the entire portfolio. Are there areas where maybe they're too aggregated? So this is one of the other powers, I think, of our platform is that we've enabled, because our model could run so quickly, we've enabled things like marginal impact studies. We have some clients that are doing some really innovative things where they're looking at different regions across the East Coast and saying, hey, this is my current book of business in a given region. Now, if I add these five or six policies, am I now busting what my risk tolerance is? Is my 100-year return period loss now gotten too large? So on a day-to-day basis, they're looking at portfolio roll-ups, say, on a monthly, but they're also looking at a portfolio basis at time of bind, oftentimes, especially for large commercial policies. So some of these things are being run with a UI, just someone who's actually just running it and clicking. But one of the really important things for us is to enable APIs and other ways that clients can automate some of this process such that they can much more quickly get to the answer that they need to see. They can program in some of this logic that they have accumulated over years and years of experience to be able to run these models very quick in an automated fashion. So from the primary perspective, that's mostly what people are doing when they're looking at the screens. Some of it is automated, some of it is by hand. But portfolio roll-up and marginal impact studies have become really important to our clients to be able to figure out, have they already busted their risk tolerance or not? Or, hey, can we actually build more capacity in these specific regions, in these areas?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great driver. And I guess that comes back to where we started about, you know, if you start with a green field with the sort of cloud-hosted solution using NVIDIA chips to be able to do this, there is a massive power of being able to do power, not in the sense of computing power, but, you know, underwriting ability to be able to utilize additional capacity if you can run a new risk coming in against your existing portfolio and see if, you know, to your point, either you've got more capacity or, well, it's time to stop underwriting. But to me, the big advantage, and this goes back to the origins of catastrophe modeling, is people can move away a little bit from just purely exposure management, and as long as they trust the models, can start to take advantage of being able to write more business, maybe even within the same reinsurance or retrocession program. And then it's good to hear that you've got the API connectivity. So people who don't necessarily want to use the user interface can actually integrate more directly into their own systems. Is that right, Brandon? You've got some choice in there.
Yeah, that's correct. And it kind of goes back to what we spoke about earlier is being transparent and working collaboratively with our clients. Is we built the general API framework and then what we've done over the last handful of years and say, what else do you need? What else would you like to do? And then because we're a very agile, you know, corporation, we're able to very quickly integrate and make sure that we're building exactly what clients want, not just what we think they might want. So always allow ourselves to be client informed in the new applications and things that we're adding to our model.
And then really just, Doug, well, both of you really, but you know, you brought in DA Associates, you brought in Jeff as your general manager. How does life look now? Other than I presume they paid you some money for the business, which must have been quite nice. You've moved from running the company now to doing that stuff I know you really enjoy, which is building the models. And I think it's great to see an organization be able to have the maturity to do that. But yeah, what's it been like in the last few months since you've been into this new mode of operating?
Yeah, very well. The new people we brought in are excellent. That's more emphasis on sales, on customer success now. And I can focus more, again, on the model building, coding every day, speaking to some clients, finding out what their pain points are, and trying to overcome those from the modeling point of view. But we were always a small company. We were 16 people when we sold the company. Now we are close to mid-20s. We're going to bring in also more technical people to cover more weather perils. We want to also cover earthquake with collaborations with Tembler and GEM. But yeah, having global weather models ready that can run on our platform in underwriting mode, in portfolio mode, enabling risk transfer all through APIs with climate conditioning and climate change capability. If you have to sum it up, that's essentially our plan. And I think our new structure allows us to reach that goal faster.
Well, I mean, you're very modest. You did very well considering putting words in your mouth, but I know this is how you think about it. You weren't coming at it from a salesperson's point of view. Last time I asked you, I think you had around 70 clients.
Yeah, and we almost never called people ourselves. We normally, in the old days, just waited and worked on models. We'll change a little bit. We probably will be more proactive in the future when it comes to looking at opportunities. You're right, we were not salespeople, but I think that was always the strength, that our customers could just call us and ask the people directly who built the models, should there be a problem or should there be praise, it goes both ways. And that will not change. We will still be accessible to our clients from a model building, model evaluation perspective, but probably just trying to explore more adjacent markets and a little bit more awareness that there's more modelers than the big legacy modelers for more clients.
Yeah, and particularly, the areas you're looking at, severe convective storm or tornado hail, the modeling community goes back probably 30 years now. They talk to each other. It's a pretty small world. A lot of people have worked together. So in a sense, if you do a good job, word gets around. If you don't do a good job, word also gets around as well. It's a different dynamic than trying to come in and sell something brand new. And you're sort of the proof is in what you do, really.
Yeah, I think it's been interesting. Just from my perspective, from the sales perspective, what I've seen in the last 4, 5, 6 months to a year is starting to see kind of the effect of spreading seeds on the wind, you could kind of say, is where a lot of our customers, they have large cat modeling teams, and we've been getting a lot of business as those people begin to go out there and start their own MGAs, start their own small insurance companies. And what we've seen time and time again, a lot of our organic sales that come in are just them. Hey, we used to work with Cat Risk. We think you guys were the best when we worked with you at that company. And so that's where some of our sales is coming in. So we're seeing that tacit endorsement from people that are leaving one company for another company or founding their own company, then come back to us and ask us for modeling.
That's great. Well, it's very much a people business. And then Dag, a personal question for you. We were neighbors at one point in South London. I'm still in South London. You've taken your family off to California. We had the chance once to go to California and we chose to stay in London. Are you going to be, is your family all happy out there? Are you going to be staying out, or have you got any plans to come back to the UK or Europe?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm from Germany originally, as you know. I moved to the States in my late 20s as part of my PhD. And then I got stuck at the National Weather Service in Washington, D.C., especially after I met my wife there. We then moved to London. We're neighbors, about 3 blocks away. My plan is to come to Europe more often in the future again, but probably largely visits. But I would like to, of course, meet clients. I typically go twice a year at least, sometimes 3 times. But yeah, it would be my plan to be more bicontinental, maybe. Not quite sure yet how to do everything in the next 10, 20 years.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? And Brandon, what about you? Austin's, I've never been there, but I hear it's a great place to be, but you're going to be spending more time over in outside of the US?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, my wife is actually English. She has dual citizenship and her family lives up in North Yorkshire. So we try to come up a few times a year, just socially, and of course also coming to London more to visit clients as well. So who knows? I'm sure all of our paths will cross frequently in the UK.
Well, I married my wife. It's also from the north of England, so they're a great bunch of people up there. Yeah, so I can see why you want to come back. So what have we got to look forward to the rest of 2024?
Project-wise,
what we have looking at from the future, obviously we're looking at U.S. wildfire, eventually moving into Canadian wildfire. That's a big peril that we're working on. We're just wrapping up our SCS models in the United States, so the full tornado, straight line winds, and hail. Hail released last year. And working on Central America and Mexico probabilistic flood models. That's coming out within the next year as well. And then I believe the timeline for that is European severe convective storm is obviously, last year was a $70 billion, global loss event for SCS. So SCS is becoming more and more important. So our immediate goals are to expand into the Europe for our full SES model and then into Canada. And then basically, as Daga said before, global probabilistic flood models are on the horizon for us.
And then on top of that, we would have hopefully earthquake models, either through GEM or Tembler or both.
Excellent. Well, the full product set. That's really impressive in 12 years' time as you start the company. Brandon, Dag, it's been really good to dig a little bit more. We got a bit technical in there, but you explained it in a reasonably clear way, and it's just really helpful to hear how these models are evolving. And in particular, as the climate's changing, you have the confidence that the models are able to reflect what we know, but also kind of the uncertainty and what we don't know. I look forward to seeing you both on the ground over here, or maybe even the US. We're doing more and more in the US now, so might be my turn to come and see you. And given the rather dismal weather here in the UK,
I recommend it.
Later. Excellent. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's good speaking with you.
Thank you, Matthew. Thanks for having us.
Well, you've made it this far, so I bet you now know a lot more about models and cat risk in particular. Well done. Now, we've been delighted to have cat risk as a member of Instec. And if you want to know how we can help you share your views of the world, or maybe just learn about what's going on around you, whether you work for a technology company or an insurance company or a broker or someone else, then please do contact us. Hello@instec.co. Check out the website, www.instec.co. Or you can get hold of me, Matthew Grant, on LinkedIn. That's it. We're done.